Blog Talk Radio.
Fanatic in the tradition of the arcane inhuman ideology,
that originated amongst British aristocracy in the 19th century. And this is, it's only about a minute and a half.
So listen to this, folks.
Webster Topley.
John P. Holdren is the resident science czar of the Obama White House. Holdren says that the optimum world population is 1 billion. The implications of his belief structure and his world outlook are genocide. This is a book called Ecoscience. This is a cookbook for the extermination of humanity. To provide a high quality of life for all, there must be fewer people, says Holdren. He says you could do this by putting chemicals in food and water. He wants to have licenses for birth. What happens to people that are born illegitimately, meaning without a birth permit? Compulsory abortion. Think about that. He even writes about infanticide. In order to enforce this, he talks about a supranational monstrosity that he calls a planetary regime. This means a world empire, a supranational one world government that would attempt to control all details of human life. This is an ultra-Hitlerian genocidalist who is today operating out of the White House in Washington, D.C., and it's time to kick him out.
I wonder what kind of influence he is on the Obama administration.
Yeah.
I mean, diabolical human being, just diabolical.
Yeah. And this guy is an appointee by Obama. Pretty damn sick.
He's one of those shadow government people.
Oh, yeah. The killing and dying just goes on, the same change. The American military suffered the deadliest attack against its forces in Iraq in more than 2 years. And Monday, when rockets slammed into a joint U.S.-Iraqi base in Baghdad, killing 5 U.S. troops and reviving concerns about security and the stability of the country's unwieldy coalition government. The attacks occurred around dawn at Camp Loyalty, known to Iraqis and Baladiyat base as Baladiyat. Base, when about 6 rockets struck near the U.S. residential quarters. According to Iraqi security officials, the rocket strikes were a part of a day of violence across Iraq that left at least 17 Iraqis dead. Insurgents detonated car bombs, booby-trapped a house with explosives, and attacked security checkpoints in the capital. And, hang on 1 second here. I'm surprised.
Iraq is the less violent.
Yeah, that this is actually from the Washington Post. Okay.
Is it?
Yeah.
Iraq is a less violent place than it has been for much of the time since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003, but recent attacks have caused unease. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is under growing pressure to assert more leadership as Iraqis face newly emboldened terrorist groups. Continuing shortages of clean water and electricity and a new national government that often appear paralyzed by mistrust. The complexity of the political situation has weakened the government in general and weakened our security forces to prevent actions by terrorists, said Falal al-Naqib, who was Interior Minister in 2004 and 2005 under former Prime Minister Iyad al-Alawi. If the situation remains as it is right now, it's going to get much more complicated and we might see a lot more problems. Maliki did not speak publicly about Monday's violence, but he appeared to acknowledge the fragile state of his government in a televised address Saturday. Neither I nor the security officials are afraid of security breaches, Maliki said, but what scares me is when the breaches have political motives. The recent violence comes as Maliki faces a crucial milestone in efforts to head off mass demonstrations similar to those in other Arab capitals. In February, after several days of demonstrations that killed nearly 2 dozen people across Iraq, Maliki asked protesters to give him 100 days to address the concerns about corruption, unemployment, and shoddy government services. With his grace period due to expire Tuesday, U.S. and Iraqi officials are increasingly concerned about the potential for more unrest as they have to try to decide whether U.S. forces should stay in the country past the end of the year. About 46,000 U.S. troops remain in Iraq, but under a three-year-old security agreement that the last American soldier is scheduled to leave the country by December 31st. Jay Carney, President Obama's press secretary, said Monday that the administration intends to comply with the agreement, but added that it would entertain requests from Iraq officials to change the government agreements if they thought that U.S. troops would be needed to ensure stability. Obama is under pressure to continue what has been a steady drawdown in Iraq, but administration officials stressed they did not want to see the security or political situation in Iraq deteriorate after the last U.S. troops leave.
There's more to it, but, you know, you can get that at Washington Post if you're really interested. 5 U.S. soldiers killed in attack on base. They're not coming out of there. They're pretty much staying there. You know what I mean?
It sure seems that way.
It's just, you know, ludicrous. But anyway, I've got a number of things I wanted to talk about tonight, and a couple of videos that I wanted to, or audios or videos that I thought would be interesting. ran across this quote today.
From Zbigniew Brzezinski?
Yeah. Zbigniew Brzezinski at a 2009 CFR meeting stated, "In earlier times, it was easier to control 1 million people than to physically kill 1 million people. Today, it is infinitely easier to kill 1 million people than to control 1 million people." Nice freaking guy, huh?
Yeah.
And this is the daddy of Mika Brzezinski that's on every morning
Morning Joe.
On Morning Joe. Yes. So, Mika, the robot, Brzezinski.
Yeah.
You know,
killing
genocide, genocider. All right. Another thing that was kind of interesting was Israelis are to protest against Netanyahu.
I saw that.
You saw that?
Uh-huh.
Did you like that?
Yes. That was they're getting together to protest Netanyahu's stance that he does not want a Palestinian state. Many Israelis support a Palestinian state.
That's right.
You never hear their voice. It's very hard to get their
voice. Maybe we should probably just show
voice
that one, because I thought it was pretty reasonably short. The Israeli and Palestinian activists are to stage a protest against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's refusal to welcome the establishment of a Palestinian state. The rally is expected to be held in Tel Aviv on Saturday under the slogan, "Netanyahu said no and we say yes to the Palestinian state, and Netanyahu is leading us to disaster." Read a statement by Israel-based NGO Peace Now, reported WAFA, the Palestinian Authority's news agency. The demonstration would take place on the eve of the anniversary of Israel 1967 occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank, East Al-Quds, Jerusalem, and Gaza Strip. Tel Aviv later annexed both the West Bank and East Al-Quds, the promised capital of any future Palestinian state. And the international community has refused to recognize either the capture or the annexation. And Israel later withdrew from Gaza, but has been keeping the region under frequent bloody attacks. And Peace Now said, "We will protest against Netanyahu's foot-dragging in establishing a Palestinian state alongside Israel and demand an immediate return to peace negotiations." Israel's direct talks with PA, or the Palestinian Authority, hit a stalemate last year after Tel Aviv refused to lift a partial freeze on its construction of illegal Jewish settlements on the occupied lands. But I'm glad to see that there's somebody protesting there in Israel. That's a good thing. I have a little bit. Would you like to hear this? The very interesting thing about how, Goldman Sachs is a freaking international criminal corporation.
Uh-huh.
All right, they stole all Gaddafi's money. All right, set him up and stole billions of dollars. All right.
which really didn't belong to them. It belongs to the people of that country.
That's right. But he invested it with Goldman Sachs, and they stole it. And this is really a
fascinating. Of course, we had to pay them off, too.
Oh, yeah.
That's why they keep getting bonuses.
I want to discuss this story. I'm joined live from Paris by RT's financial muckraker, Max Kaiser, of course, the host of RT's Kaiser Report. Max, good to see you there. Now, that report in the Financial Times suggests that the bankers were quite happy to invest Gaddafi's money. Does that come as a surprise to you that these huge banks were dealing with Gaddafi?
Well, what I'm hearing is that Frederick Udeh, the CEO of Societe Generale, Lloyd Blankfein, CEO of Goldman Sachs, and Tony Blair have all been marked for death by Libyan assassins as a campaign to rectify what Libya perceives as a blatant disregard for their sovereign wealth fund. And Libya is experiencing what many people in America and around the world are experiencing, financial rape by bankers, whether it's Dominic Strauss-Kahn or with the IMF, or whether it's Lloyd Blankfein, or whether it's Frederick Udeh. Everyone's getting financially raped by these bankers, and we can only guess as to what the outcome might be. Of course, this all goes back to 2004 when Tony Blair was in Libya and doing deals with Muammar Gaddafi. Even at that time, my understanding is that he was setting banks up in the West to swoop in and start to pick apart the sovereign wealth fund. And, of course, when Tony Blair left number 10 Downing Street, he took a position with J.P. Morgan. He went right to J.P. Morgan, and he started setting Libya up for these deals immediately, and they just was throwing a blood to the shark. So Goldman Sachs swooped in, Societe Generale swooped in, and now they've all been marked for death from what I understand.
Okay, Max, but Libya clearly lost a lot of money here. What can you explain what went wrong for Libya, or in the light of what you've just said, what went right for the banks? What happened?
Well, the banks are financial terrorists, and the way that they conduct their operations, whether it's subprime lending markets that they fraudulently induce, you know, Goldman Sachs is now being investigated again for more fraud, more accounting fraud, more criminality. Lloyd Blankfein wants to be brought before Congress to be questioned again for potential perjury. You know, everything that they touch, they turn to some kind of act of larceny or accounting fraud. And this is how they pay themselves $140 billion in bonuses at the end of the year in an economy that's collapsing as jobs are disappearing, as the food stamp program increases. By the way, food stamps are the invention and creation and administration of J.P. Morgan. So they make money out of creating and running ghettos. They make money out of financial terrorism. When these markets crash, they make billions. Hank Paulson and his crew made billions on the bailout in 2008. This is the way you conduct financial terrorism. And all the money that Obama has been spending to fight so-called terrorism elsewhere in the world, he would do the world a great big favor by going down to Wall Street, arresting the financial terrorists, and throwing them in Guantanamo Bay and having them tortured, of course, because of their crimes against humanity.
A little earlier, you were saying that many Libyans want the heads of certain people on the block, the likes of Blair and, of course, these bank executives. But could Libya get their money back, or could the banks actually refuse to pay what they've lost?
Well, the banks have at their disposal. For example, right now, in the United States, there is talk about the debt ceiling. And they want to raise the debt ceiling, and people in America don't want to raise the debt ceiling. So what Wall Street is telling Washington and the American people, either you raise the debt ceiling or we're going to crash the stock market, because they use weapons of mass financial destruction. So they use markets as a weapon. And this is what they're telling people in America right now. Give us more debt so that we can finance more speculative bets. We can go into more foreign countries. We can load up more countries in debt. And, of course, that will force those countries to put their folks into austerity, like we're seeing in Greece. Again, Lloyd Blankfein, CEO of Goldman Sachs, and John Paulson, hedge fund manager, were in Greece 2 years before the recent austerity measures, plotting the takedown of Greece and the carve-up of those assets. Again, who in the world has the balls to take these bankers down to the chopping block and frickin' get rid of them, like they did back 200 years ago? That's the only solution.
All right, Max, just quickly, in the light of what's happening in Libya, what next? Will we see, once it all settles in Libya, whatever the outcome of the current problems there, will we see all those banks then capitalizing on a broken country and getting their money back due to all the resources that are there? I mean, what happens next? Will we see those banks jumping on the bandwagon in Libya later?
Well, right now they're focusing on destroying Greece. They're focusing on destroying Ireland. They've already got multi-hundred billion dollar negative bets on these countries, and they're, you know, to make billions of dollars. The Moody's, S&P and Fitch are in bed with these people. They downgrade the debt, and they're all working together. They're all working as a team. It's collusion. It's a racket. It's racketeering. So, yeah, the banks will continue to rape and pillage like a Dominic Strauss-Kahn who performs financial rape as his daily gist. That's what he – if it wasn't for financial rape, we'd never have a Dominic Strauss-Kahn. If you look up financial rape in the dictionary, you'll see a picture of Dominic Strauss-Kahn. That's what he was born to do. He was groomed to be a financial rapist, and he's brilliant at it. And so is Lloyd Blankfein. So is Jamie Dimon. And so is Sock Gen. And so are these other bankers. Who's going to stop them? Who's going to stop them?
Right. Well, what is the answer to that? Who will stop them? It's the law of soft touch. What are the international regulations? You're getting very passionate about this. Answer your own question. Who could actually stop them doing what you say they're doing?
I believe it was Rousseau who said, when the social contract is broken, the people must revolt. It's up to the people. Revolt now or be a debt slave.
All right, Max, thanks very much indeed. Persuasive response there, an argument from Max Kaiser live from Paris. Good to hear you once again. And of course, Max will be back again with the Kaiser Report here on RT. Thanks a lot, Max.
Right. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, that was very good.
I thought that was good. Yeah.
Very informative.
Yeah.
Boy.
There's a kind of a short one here I wanted to get across to you tonight. It's about Wall Street's role in narco trafficking.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Imagine what your reaction would be if a Mexican government agreed to pay Barack Obama $1.4 billion to deploy U.S. troops and armored vehicles to New York.
Hmm. We wouldn't like that too much.
Los Angeles and Chicago to conduct military operations, set up checkpoints, and engage in firefights that end up killing 35,000 U.S. civilians on the streets of American cities. If the Mexican government treated the U.S. like this, would you consider them a friend or an enemy? That is exactly how the U.S. is treating Mexico, and it's been going on since 2006. Do you want to read that, or
sure.
can you? Or,
yeah.
You sure?
America's Mexican policy, the Merida initiative, is a nightmare. It's undermined Mexican sovereignty, corrupted the political system, and militarized the country. It's also resulted in the violent deaths of thousands of mostly poor civilians. But Washington doesn't give a hoot about collateral damage as long as it can sell more weaponry, strengthen its free trade regime, and sluice more drug profits into its big banks. Then everything is just Jim Dandy. There's no point in dignifying this butchery by calling it a war on drugs. That's nonsense. What we're seeing is a giant power grab by big business, big finance, and the U.S. intel services. Obama is merely doing their bidding, which is why, not surprisingly, things have gotten a lot worse under his administration. Obama has not only stepped up the funding from Plan Mexico, a.k.a. Meridia, but also deployed more U.S. agents to work undercover while U.S. drones carry out surveillance duty. Get the picture? This isn't some little drug bust. It's another chapter in America's war on civilization. Here is an excerpt from an article in Counterpunch by Laura Carlson that gives a little background.
The drug war has become a major vehicle of militarization in Latin America. It's a vehicle funded and driven by the U.S. government and fueled by a combination of false morals, hypocrisy, and a lot of cold, hard fear. The so-called war on drugs is really a war on people, especially youth, women, indigenous peoples, and dissidents. The drug war has become the main way for the Pentagon to occupy and control countries at the expense of whole societies and many, many lives. Militarization is the name of the drug war. Is happening more quickly and more roughly, thoroughly than most of us probably anticipated under the Obama administration. The agreement to establish bases in Colombia, later suspended, sent out one of the first signals of the strategy. And we've seen the indefinite extension of the Merida initiative in Mexico and Central America, and even, sadly, warboats sent to Costa Rica, a nation with a history of peace and no army. The Merida
Initiative
funds U.S. interests to train security forces, provide intelligence and war technology, give advice on reforming the justice and penal systems, and promoting human rights, all in Mexico. The drug war can't be improved. It can only be ended. Laura Carlson, counterpunch.
If it looks like Obama is doing his best to turn Mexico into a military dictatorship, it's because he is. Playing Mexico is a sham that conceals the administration's real motive, which is to make sure that the lavish profits from the drug trade end up in the right people's pockets. That's what this is all about, big money. And that's why the death toll has soared while the Mexican government's credibility has hit its lowest ebb in decades. U.S. policy has turned large swaths of the country into killing fields, and it's only getting worse. Check out this interview with Charles Bowden, who describes what life is like for the people who live at ground zero in the drug war in Juarez, Mexico. This is in a city where people live in cardboard boxes sometimes. 10,000 businesses have given up and closed in the last year. 30 to 60,000 people from Juarez, mainly the rich, have moved across the river to El Paso for safety, including the mayor of Juarez, who likes to bunk in El Paso, and the publisher of the newspaper there lives in El Paso. Somewhere between 100,000 and 400,000 people simply left the city. A lot of the problem is economic, not simply violence. At least 100,000 jobs in the border factories have vanished during this recession because of the competition from Asia. There's 500 to 900 gangs there. Estimates vary, though. So what you have is about 10,000 federal troops and federal police agents all marauding. You have a city where no one goes out at night, where officials, where small businesses all pay extortion, where 20,000 cars were officially stolen last year, where 2,600-plus people were officially murdered last year, where nobody keeps track of the people who have been kidnapped and never come back, where nobody counts the people buried in a secret burying ground and they, in an unseemly way, claw out of the earth from time to time. You've got a disaster, and you have a million people too poor to leave imprisoned in it. That's the city. That's from Charles Bowden, Democracy Now! This isn't about drugs. It's about a crackpot fallen policy that supports proxy armies to impose order through police state repression and militarization. It's about expanding U.S. power and beefing up profits on Wall Street. Here's more background from author Lawrence M. Vance at the Future of Freedom Foundation. You want to get that an undisclosed number?
Yeah, no, I think I'll stop there because we got...
Okay. Kind of goes on. It's a very long article.
It's a long
article. I guess we
article.
Can't really finish it.
Actually, it's not that long, but...
But I think people get the picture.
You get the picture. You know, it's pretty
grim
and doomed down there. And it's because of our stupid policies and our, you know, corporations laundering monies. And Obama just keeping his eyes happy and blind, you know. This is something that I ran into that I studied myself when I was in college, actually, by a Ukrainian professor. And it was about the Ukrainian genocide.
Oh, okay.
In 1933, I believe, and by Stalin. And this is really an indictment against the New York Times reporter that was reporting for that time period, and how the New York Times ever since, I mean, has basically covered up every major, every major story, all right, to some degree, and really made it into nothing. So this is just a few minutes long, but it's well worth listening to. All right?
A shape of thought.
Yes.
In the early 1930s, Americans received much of their news. Times Man in Moscow. Durante's art. filled the front pages with gripping stories from Mother Russia. During that period, Joseph Stalin was consolidating power over the captive nations.
Oh, it's not worth saying, Leo. It keeps shutting off.
Yeah.
Well, let's get to something else. But you can tell people, you know, about it. I'm sorry to say that could be very annoying to listen to when it keeps shutting off.
Yeah, it's, you can go to YouTube and go to New York Times Concealed Ukrainian Genocide.
Malcolm Muggeridge. He witnessed the loading of thousands of Ukrainians into boxcars. They were being deported to barren regions of the Soviet Union. This program of Stalin's alone accounted for more than 1 minute.
Actually, it was about it came up to over 7 million deaths in Ukraine in his time that he held food from them. And
starve them all. So what was the point behind this manipulation of facts and history?
Well, it's basically that what they're saying is this guy, whatever his name was,
from the New York Times,
Tony or whatever, got a Pulitzer Prize for that year. Okay, the year that he was supposed to cover this thing,
mm-hmm.
He covered nothing about it. Right, there was no mention of the genocide and of the transportation of those people, of the displacement of all of the Ukrainian people, taken into Siberia and all these other places. The reason they did that is because they were protesting the. They protested, basically, Stalin's regime.
I know, but what was the purpose of the manipulation of the New York Times?
That's the way they are, Lila. The New York Times...
Well, I was just wondering in what context that was.
Reporters were talking about, a British reporter who actually did cover this thing and reported to the British press, stated that this is what was really happening, and then he couldn't believe that the New York Times reporter censored all the information, said nothing in the papers about it. Okay, in fact, if there was any mention at all, it was a whitewashing of it.
I realize that, but I wonder what the purpose of that was.
Well, the purpose is that New York Times, Washington Post, all of mainstream media...
I understand that, but I wonder... It'd be interesting to know in the context of
the
politics of why.
Well, they say it in this, but basically, this country, supported... Stalin, all right? We supported Lenin. We supported all these guys to get these communists off the ground. And then we supported Stalin through World War II, all right? And
this was in 1933, folks.
This was 33, I believe, yes. But when Stalin had taken over, and I wish this tape were worth to play without all these hesitations.
But that's just
very
annoying. Yeah.
But you can go into the Ukrainian genocide and go to YouTube, New York Times Concealed Ukrainian Genocide, and see what they say about it. It's a fascinating time in history that's been incredibly revisionized, revisioned. And,
right while it was going on.
Right while it was going on and now. So, by our beloved New York Times, such a wasteoid paper.
Tool of the elite,
right. Our guest, Larry, was supposed to call at 8:30. I don't know what
it's just a few minutes beyond. I'm sure he'll call.
And I can actually dial him if that might be.
Well, we'll wait till
we'll wait. See,
we'll wait about 10 minutes and see what happens. I know he wanted to have a short interview tonight. He's been on the road all the time, poor guy.
Yeah, he just came back from Washington, D.C. Today, but he wanted to do it tonight, so that's okay. Let's see. So much here that I wanted to talk about tonight. I was going to wait for our music break for this, but we could do a little music break. I wish you would hear this. It's one of the loveliest things I've heard in years. But Korea's Got Talent, is a show
mm-hmm.
America's Got Talent. And the title says, I dare you not to cry while watching this. This is another one of those Paul Pot and Susan Boyle kind of performances. but it was given by a kid named Sang Bong Choi, who was a 14, 15-year-old homeless boy.
Oh, my goodness.
He'd been homeless since he was 5 years old.
Oh, my God.
Right? Had no parents, okay? Escaped from an orphanage and was on the streets till now, and he came into this audition.
Oh, here's Larry.
Right. We'll play this later.
We'll play that later. Let's
go to Larry.
We'll go to Larry.
Greetings.
Larry.
How are you?
How are you?
We're fine. How are you? I know you've been all over the United States, it seems. Just
feels like
working
it.
Very hard, huh?
Feels like it. We're right now the big challenge is the tentative agreement we have with the Malloy administration. So that has a big impact, too, on all the cities and towns. So a lot's riding on that vote.
Yeah, that's an interesting budget, that's for sure. I know it didn't please a lot of people, and I know that it depended on the state employees unions. Now, was all that voting completed? Did they vote for that agreement?
No. Actually, none of it has really formally even started yet. Lila and Leo, it's going to be over the next couple of weeks. There are 34 different bargaining units under the state employee coalition umbrella, and I think possibly as late as this week, but certainly through next week, the bulk of the voting will take place.
I know originally a lot of state employees were really scared and afraid, and you know they had some misinformation. Have they calmed down? Have they been able to accept some of the what Malloy is going to do? Is it are they less frightened than they were originally?
Yeah. Good question, and I think that the more we're able to get out, and that's certainly been a big part of my life lately, the more we can get out and talk to people, the more meetings we have, the more emails we can answer, I think the better people feel, the more confident we are in the in a positive outcome for the ratification vote. But interestingly, so many of the emails that were circulating against pieces of this agreement, particularly the novel approach we're taking from healthcare, really seemed like pages out of a right-wing playbook. On the one hand, there was something going around that our healthcare plan was going to be tied into the Sustinet legislation, and it was Obamacare and socialized medicine, and the tentative agreement has nothing to do with the proposed Sustinet legislation, which in my mind is barely alive anyway. And then it became an issue that we were trying to force people to get care that they didn't want, and many of the links in the emails went back to the Yankee Institute, which is a far-right think tank here in Connecticut. I believe they're funded by Cato Institute and others. So we think that there are actually some outside forces like the Yankee Institute, like Republican legislators, who want to torpedo the agreement because they want to see chaos. They want to see layoffs. They want to see
This is all part of the Koch thing, isn't it? A Koch ad.
You know, it wouldn't surprise me in the end, Leo. Certainly I can't say that it's Koch money, but it's certainly that playbook, which is to fund these kind of shadow operations that distort and lie and try to smear what public employees are doing. And so, but I think we're overcoming it. In fact, I know we're overcoming it, and we are just really busy talking to the members, having informational meetings. We had a statewide meeting at the Armory in Hartford, and the reception was great. More and more workers walked out of that saying, I understand it, I'm voting yes, and we want that yes vote because it's going to stop layoffs, it's going to protect public services, it's going to make sure the cities and towns get the funding they need for local government services. So I think in the end it will be win-win for everyone.
Do you know what happened in Wisconsin? We haven't really heard anything more.
Yeah. Well, I have a lot to tell you about that, actually. I just flew back today from Washington, D.C. AFSCME had what's called the Battleground States Summit. And it really is I had to leave a day early, but it's basically a conference for AFSCME members around the country to talk about the different fights that are going on against unions and against workers, and I should say against public employees, unions, and really all workers. So we heard a lot from Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio, which are three of the really notorious battleground states, in that you've got really bad governors there trying to do bad things. So Wisconsin is in a bit of a flux. They still are getting thousands of people when they need to at rallies. And what's interesting, they had an election for state Supreme Court justice that they barely lost. They were trying to unseat a Republican who has been rubber stamping Scott Walker's anti-union legislation. They have an injunction now against that legislation, but it's going to have to go and be heard in the Supreme Court, which has a majority of conservative judges. So the Wisconsin union folks are not optimistic about that outcome. However, they also have, I believe, six Republican senators up for recall. They got ballots. They got enough signatures on the ballot. And tell you and your listeners a very funny story. So this summer there will be elections to unseat these Republicans, and these are the Republicans who bought into Scott Walker's anti-union plan. When our sisters and brothers in Wisconsin were petitioning in the neighborhoods to get signatures, enough to get the required signatures for a ballot, they actually knocked on the door of one of the Republican state senators who was notoriously anti-union. His wife answered the door, and she said, "Give me that clipboard. I'm signing it. That bastard's in Wisconsin with his girlfriend." I'm sorry, he's in Madison with his girlfriend. So she signed the petition, apparently made a donation to the campaign to unseat her husband. So they're fighting.
Boy.
They're fighting in the courts. They're going to be fighting in the elections, and by having these elections. And they haven't lost their spirit. It's really incredible. And
That's wonderful.
Well,
what about recalling the governor? Any possibility of that?
That is not on the plate, apparently, because I think it's just too difficult to pull that off. But his popularity has shrunk considerably, and he's been weakened. And they're having buyers and voters remorse parties around Wisconsin. So they're really going to keep the pressure on him. So I think that while they're stuck with him for the foreseeable future, it looks like he's been weakened.
Yeah, I was very surprised that I didn't think Wisconsin was such a Republican state.
I didn't either, and that's what people are kind of scratching their heads about, Leo, is how did this happen in one of the more progressive states with a deep and rich union history? But November 2010 was a strange time, and people who had no business being swept into power got swept into power. And, you know, moderation was thrown out the window in Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio and Florida and other places. So it is a fascinating study, and I need to learn a little bit more about the undercurrents that led to this happening, and because it was shocking.
We certainly don't want to see that happen in this state.
I think that's the context that we're trying to talk to our members on the state side. We certainly have our issues and our disagreements and our problems with the Malloy administration. He hasn't been particularly helpful when he keeps talking about layoffs and when he talked about $2 billion in concessions. But the fact remains that at least we could talk to his representatives and try to reach a tentative agreement in a fairly trustful and quiet atmosphere. And that would never have happened with a governor like Scott Walker or Chris Christie from New Jersey, who just loves to treat public employees as scapegoats and blame them for the problems the cities and towns are having. So to that degree, I think we're in better hands with this governor, but we'll certainly have our disagreements and our fights, and we've got to get ratification. That's not a simple thing with 34 different bargaining units, so we got to get through that first.
So,
and I think we have to stay on the ball with him, too.
That would be my point. Well, that's why you said it better than I did, Lila.
How much longer do you have to get them signed?
To get it ratified?
Yeah.
Yeah, the clock is ticking because the new fiscal year begins July 1st. And you know, obviously unions have notification rules. They have it's a cumbersome process trying to arrange voting for 43,000 employees who belong to 34 different bargaining units. But the short answer to your question, Leo, is that all the voting will be wrapped up by June 24th, and the ballots will all be in, counted, everything will be tabulated, and we'll know where we stand on June 24th. And that gives us a week.
Yeah, he's got those 5,000 layoffs slated for, what, the
July 30th? Well, as early as July 1st. Now, he's actually, and he said it again today, I believe. I was out of state, but I understand he reiterated it, that he's actually talking now about more than 7,000 and cuts in services, programs. So it's going to be an ugly scenario if we don't get this tentative agreement ratified. So that's why we're focusing so much energy on making sure we get a yes vote.
And, he's and really holding those pink slips over your head, really.
It does, and it certainly has a debilitating effect on the workers. But generally, people are plotting ahead. They're doing their jobs. They're trying to keep informed. And you guys understand this because of what you do. It's just, it's no fun being blamed for a problem you didn't create and for to clean up the mess at a party to which you were never invited and never sanctioned.
You got that right. It's very, very difficult. Very tough.
You know, I'm telling you, I read about Goldman Sachs and all these fat cats are still making out, and the structural problems with this economy still persist, and it's got nothing to do with a paraprofessional or a sanitation worker or a correction officer having a pension and decent health care. You know, we're not the problem.
Well, you'll be interested in this. This is just a little aside to that, how we still get blamed. I was at a presentation today by very earnest people on bringing fiscal responsibility to kids at school, teaching them about money and saving and all that kind of stuff, which I think it has a lot of value. But in addition to that statement, the add-on to that statement was, it's because we didn't save enough. It's the people that caused the problem in this economy.
That's incredible.
I got red. I was so mad. And, of course, it wasn't the format really to say anything.
Right.
But, I mean, that's what people believe. They've been told it so much, they believe
right.
It's fault.
Yeah, people have just been indoctrinated, fooled, hypnotized, whatever words you want to use. Because how did the people cause this? We in fact, are reading, reading an article by Matt Taibbi in Rolling Stone, and it looks like we could be headed for another Wall Street mess. It just doesn't stop. It's got nothing to do with regular working people who
right.
just are trying to make a living, pay their taxes, live honestly, and spend money on Main Street. It just at least on a positive side, there was the patriotic millionaires put out their statement today saying that the rich should be taxed, and that's a positive sign, actually.
Yeah, they've said that a number of times, and there just doesn't seem to be any response.
Congress won't listen, huh?
No. I mean,
right.
I've heard that three or four times, or maybe they say it because they know there'll be no response to it.
I also get to thinking, Wienergate and everything else is what consumes our nation's energy and what's left of our intellect. So.
Yeah, isn't that something? That story's been all over everything. That's all they talk about on the mainstream news. You can't get it.
No, and meanwhile we have kids dying in the Middle East, but that's not news.
No, that's not something they want to talk about. And I was wondering how things are going in New Haven, if you still have your finger on that.
Absolutely. We are we've completed the arbitration discussions with the city, and we're still pushing to have the privatization proposal withdrawn and save 200 school custodians. And on a positive note, we've actually are supporting three candidates who are proud to be associated with unions or union members. They are going to run for the Board of Alders in New Haven, and their platform is we're going to challenge John DeStefano, and we're not going to rubber stamp everything he does. So slowly but surely, I think we're kind of turning the tide a little bit down there. And I apologize for not being on, but I think had I been able to get on your show earlier, I would have been telling you how we actually have Yale University angry at us too, because we've been saying that Yale kind of snookered the city with a 20-year lease agreement on some city streets that they turned into their that they have used for Yale, and we are pushing this DeStefano administration to ask Yale to pony up money that we feel that they owe for having had the access and the use and the construction that took place on that on a major street in downtown New Haven. So now Yale's upset, DeStefano's upset. So we're keeping the temperature high down there, and we have to do that.
Well, good for you.
What do you? Just as an aside here, I'm very curious. What do you think of the latest Republican candidates? President,
I'm underwhelmed.
Now the latest is Santorum.
And where did that come from?
He is the most egotistical.
Boneheaded.
You talk about a guy who's you're dealing with an egotistical human being when he just bombed out as a senator, but somehow feels he has the chops to run for president. Yeah.
Well, it's no different than Johnny Edwards, you know.
Oh
yeah.
Man, did he blow a gasket there?
Can you imagine though how everybody, so many people were lining up in his camp? It's turned out to be a good thing that.
I remember you and I. I think you had mentioned. I don't know if you were.
Originally, when he came out of the gate, thought he might
have been a good candidate.
I think it could very well have been me, because he had a
very strong union support.
He had, he had good relationships with the unions in North Carolina, and he was a guy who came up from the ranks and fought for the underdog and made a ton of money doing it. But I think we, at some point, you and I, the three of us, were probably talking about why isn't John Edwards on the radar screen when Obama was looking for a VP candidate, and he just got so quiet, and I think that they had vetted him, and they must have known that something was going to explode with this guy. But getting back to your question, Mitt Romney just frightens the hell out of me. He's kind of a rich, empty-headed suit. And Pawlenty from Minnesota was an anti-union, anti-public work service kind of governor. So, we're just seeing more of the radical right emerge in the field.
No, but Bachman is doing well in Iowa.
You could end up if Palin isn't on the ticket, you could certainly see I could see Bachman being there. But again, I'm kind of secretly, or not so secretly, hoping that these are the people who emerge, because they're radical, they're out of touch, they are trying to play to the Tea Party base, and they're not able to govern, and they don't have any vision for governing. So it will be a stark contrast. But the president needs to. President needs to pick it up a little bit.
I don't really think this guy's got much of a shot either. If anybody right now would run as an independent, as much as I question Trump or Ron Paul, those two guys might have a shot.
Well, I think Trump was a put up guy, and he loved the spotlight.
Oh,
he got so much publicity out of that for
But anybody right now, anybody running as an independent.
I like the philosophy of Ron Paul, because he appears to be an honest guy, but the problem is he's a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And he
wants things to go back 200 years.
I don't like his social ideas, but I do like his foreign policy ideas, and I do like his monetary policy.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot that I like about him.
I think what I'd like to see is Obama, the candidate, finally become Obama the president if he wins re-election. And that would be, that would offset the need for us to even have this conversation if Obama and Democrats would actually behave like Democrats and be responsible and responsive to the people.
Yeah, I just
I wonder if that's wishing for pie in the sky.
Yeah,
though,
no,
you know?
I totally understand that. Yeah,
he's such a disappointment as a president.
Right, and you know, the alternative is so much worse that I think he will rise to the occasion in the campaign. And I think that with a, if he can get the second term, and hopefully the Democrats retake the House, then I think we can chart a different direction and a better direction, I would hope. But, you know, again, I read so much about, I've been trying to read and learn and continue to learn about the Wall Street debacles that have taken this country's economy down. And so many of those guys have access, and they are guys, and they have access and power to within Washington and within the Obama administration, that it's very troubling.
Well, the Goldman Sachs is under indictment again.
Yep.
And for perjury and everything else in front of the Senate committee.
Right.
And, you know, and there's a major investigation going on with them now, a judicial investigation going on with them.
Yeah, but, you know, Geithner's their guy, you know. So we're going to have to see. But I think the 2012 campaign will bring out the that great candidate we saw. And then if he's fortunate enough to win, then he needs to, as a president, he needs to be the candidate. And he needs to put those principles into action and into power.
He hasn't. I don't really see him. I don't have that kind of faith in him at all after what he did in the last 3 years.
Yeah, so I totally understand your skepticism.
Even though I voted for him, you know, I just couldn't do it again. Nor could I for anybody as a Republican. I don't know what I'd do.
I'd like to see a good, strong, independent candidate, but that's you know, not happening, I guess.
Yeah.
It's interesting Romney comes from interesting stock. I have no, I do not like the guy at all. I just think he's an arrogant, smug guy who inherited a ton of wealth. But his father, George Romney, from Michigan, was a moderate Republican who had good relationships with the trade unions in Michigan. And he was actually that kind of old school Republican who could help get things done and didn't just demonize unions and workers. And it's interesting that he's just a far cry from his father. And, you know, we need some of that moderation return to American politics, but certainly Mitt Romney's not the guy.
Well, the only good thing he did was help pass that health care in Massachusetts when he was governor. Now, I don't know whether he supported it or not.
Right.
I really don't know that much about Matthew.
Yeah, I don't. I suspect, you know, it was going to happen, but he certainly didn't get in the way of it.
He signed the bill.
Yep, exactly.
Yep.
And, I guess sometimes he ducks from it, and then other times he embraces it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be an issue when he campaigns. Did he or did he not actually believe in it and support it? And so we'll see.
Yeah, I would be surprised if he makes it as a front runner. You know, he's tried so many times.
I know, but, you know, in this climate of great dissatisfaction and great fear, who knows? It's so unpredictable. And, you know, I'm not even willing to rule out somebody like Trump or somebody crazy like Palin. They've got money, they've got access to the media, and they could easily, you know, kind of buy their way into a nomination. So who knows?
And the media certainly loves it when people say stupid things.
Yep.
And that's what they seem to spend their time talking about, as with Sarah Palin and the famous ride of Paul Revere. I mean, she could practically rewrite history.
she can, and yet that seems to embolden her to do more. You know, do more and say more, and it certainly doesn't seem to hurt her among her base. But I just don't think that she would give up the wealth and the fame she's getting to run for office.
I don't think so either. You know, that's why Donald Trump backed down immediately after NBC offered him $60 million to stay with The Apprentice.
Right. Why would you give that up? Now maybe we'll see Ralph Nader again.
Oh, what? Boy, he's got to be in his... How old is he now?
He's Ron Paul's age.
76,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. I saw him in New Haven last month. He spoke at the church in New Haven. Interesting guy. Still an interesting guy.
It was, yeah.
How strong was his talk, Larry, when you saw him?
It was good. It was actually... my boss, Sal Luciano, was honored by Between the Lines, the radio program down in out of at WPKN in Bridgeport. And they honored Ralph Nader and the Universal Healthcare Foundation and our union, Council 4. So after my boss, after Sal and after the Juan Figueroa from the Healthcare Foundation gave some short speeches, Ralph went on for about an hour, and he was as strong as ever. In fact, he was very critical of the AFL-CIO and the labor movement leadership, the National Labor Union leadership. So he kind of sparked a little bit of a debate, even in the crowd of some of the union people who were there. So I don't think he's lost his ability to convey a point with passion and with argumentation. So interesting guy.
Yeah, we've heard him speak a couple of times, not recently. But
yeah, we were Nader Raiders, not Nader Raiders, but
Nader supporters.
Nader LeDuc supporters back in 2000.
Yeah, definitely.
And we covered I covered his campaign, actually, for his Connecticut campaign. We did a number of documentaries on him.
Oh, really?
And television shows, during that time.
That was kind of fun.
And interviewed him a number of times. But we, he's a great guy. But
he's very bright, very bright guy.
Yeah, very bright. But he just couldn't get a chance, They couldn't give him a chance, and they wouldn't give him a chance.
Nope.
And
he kept
biting at their legs, and he still.
Yeah, he hasn't lost. That's a good way to put it. He hasn't lost that ability.
Yeah. So they just keep biting at their legs. That's about all we do.
So what's up next?
At least maybe it hurts once in a while.
So what's up next for you, Larry? Where are you going to concentrate your efforts now that you're back here in Connecticut?
Well, we're going to, we're focused on getting the ratification done. We're hoping to obviously get that yes vote from our state employees so we can continue fighting in the cities and towns to protect services there. And we're heading into municipal elections. We want to try to get some AFSCME members elected, including New Haven, and we want to get ready for 2012. And I think that part of our thinking, too, is that once we can get through the ratification process for the state employees, we really want to step up our campaign for a fair economy. I think that's the root of everything. It's not that public employees have health care and pension. It's Wall Street, it's the corporations, it's the rich not paying enough taxes. We've got to refocus on that fight for a fair economy.
One question before, I know it's getting late for you there, but I've been seeing clips of you on the local news, right? And clips is probably not the word, because they were so quick.
Yeah, I know.
All right. I mean, my God, did they take anything you said out of context, or did they just grab a soundbite?
I think, you guys, if anybody knows how they operate, you can talk to a reporter for 5 or 7 or 10 minutes, and you get 7 or 8, if you're lucky. And that's just, we're constantly doing interviews about the, throughout this whole process, and it's very difficult. You're not going to get equal time with the governor or with legislators, but I'm certainly trying to get out as much as I can, and I talk to reporters from Patch.
We're very happy to see you. See you out there at least a couple of times.
Very often we'd see you at 6 in the morning.
Yeah, 6 in the morning.
That's when they put me on, huh? Well, there's been no lack of interest from the press, but we've been as helpful as we can, and we're trying to, it's a good way at least to get the message out to the public that we're part of the solution, and we'll keep being part of the solution.
They seem to be treating you carefully anyway. I mean, as far as the union goes,
that's interesting.
On these, on what I've seen. on their report about the unions.
I think there's a lot of people support what's happening.
I think there's a lot of support from the unions as well. That's good to hear.
I appreciate your feedback. Look, we've always said that there's a broader economic context that can't be lost, and that's the context of this economy and the way it's worked for the super rich and the corporations, and it's not working for the people we represent. For many of your listeners, it's not working the way it should. So we've tried to keep things in that context, and I think that that's a reminder.
What bothered me most about Malloy, and I have to say, is not only did he not put in a wealth tax, in the state, but he took so much from everyone else.
Exactly.
Raising the sales tax and knocking out these taxes and this tax, and he even took away these rest areas now in the state.
Right.
And the highways. It's like, man.
I think as a person in education, the thing I think that bothered me the most is everything
that he did was
the elimination of the technical schools.
Right, which isn't going to happen. I mean, unless we've got to get this tentative agreement ratified. I think the technical schools would stay open, but you're absolutely right. To even consider eliminating them is
that.
Because that's a path to employment for so many.
Exactly.
It was completely draconian and heartless. And stupid. Because where are your tradesmen going to come from? Where are where are all the technical skilled people going to come from?
You know what? Yeah. Pop a toll up in Greenwich, and if you're afraid to tax rich people, or you're afraid to close the loopholes, even though 2/3 of Connecticut's big corporations barely paid $250 in income tax, throw up a toll booth, put the proceeds into education and the roads, and all of a sudden Connecticut will be in better shape. That's why I think it's really important that we kind of revive that fight for a fair economy that works for everybody, not just the corporations, not just the super rich.
Well, we thank you, Larry, very much.
Thank you. Sorry it took me so long to get back, but I look forward to continuing to chat.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And keep up the good.
Yeah, we'll keep watching for you.
Good. Appreciate it, Leo and Lila. Thanks.
Good night.
Take care.
That was Larry Dorman talking to us, a public affairs coordinator for AFSCME Union Council 4.
Yep.
And he just came back from Washington. They had a big meeting down there. So we are not the only state that's had trouble with its governor. So we're in a little better shape than some of the other states. At least they could talk and bargain with him. And the union is about to ratify, I guess, the state employees.
Yeah, it sounds really encouraging, but
but they had to accept some things.
Yeah.
But there's also some good parts to that. I heard some of what they have in that agreement.
Mm.
But it's going to be tough for members, they're going to have some cutbacks. So.
Yeah, what made me laugh today? When I was, the other day, when Sarah Palin made that famous Paul Revere warn the British remark, and somebody on Facebook said it to me, and I had to put it back up. So I wanted to play that. That's only about 30 seconds.
On Paul Revere?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But here we go. I want to play this.
It appears Sarah Palin may need to brush up on her American history. She visited the Old North Church today here in Boston, the focal point of Paul Revere's historic ride, but it sounds like she got a bit confused on the details.
He who warned us British that they weren't going to be taking away our arms by ringing those bells and making sure as he's riding his horse through town to send those warning shots and bells that we were going to be secure and we were going to be free.
That was enough if that wasn't enough to not vote for Sarah Palin, I don't know.
She thinks she can run for president. It's just amazing.
I know. Well, Rick Santorum thinks he can run for president. Mitt Romney thinks he can. Everybody thinks they can. Obama thought he could, and he did,
He won.
He didn't have any experience.
Okay.
So, it's things like this that make you kind of, grow weary. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. go back to the ranch here in a second. And I'm going to pick up a few more articles here.
Okay, maybe we have a little audio that we could play.
Yeah, we do. Oh, we do. Okay,
hang
on a second. This was exciting. This was very exciting news, folks. The prominent Swiss politician calls for the arrest of Henry Kissinger at Bilderberg meeting.
Yeah, they're going to have a meeting soon.
Yeah. A prominent member of Switzerland's largest political party has called upon federal authorities to arrest Henry Kissinger as a war criminal if he attends the 2011 Bilderberg Conference of Global Power Brokers, which is set to begin on Thursday at the Hotel Serretta House in Saint-Moritz. Hang on one second here. I'm going right in there. Swiss People Party representative Dominique Batigue wrote a letter to the general prosecutor of the Swiss Federation in which he asked, in the name of cantonal sovereignty and independence, but especially of this justice and independence from the executive power, may it be federal or cantonal?
I ask you
to check abroad for arrest warrants delivered by various courts, judges, and also for all valid criminal complaints against the persons who are, amongst others, cited as mere examples in my enclosed letters to Mr. Simonetta Samaruga, federal counselor, and Mrs. Barbara Geno Steiner, cantonal counselor, and, of course, to arrest them from diligent extraditions.
Before
diligent extradition, sorry. Batigue is no fringe figure. He's the equivalent of a U.S. congressman representing the canton of Jura on the National Council of Switzerland. His party, the Swiss People's Party, is the largest party in the Federal Assembly with 58 members of the National Council and 6 of the state councils, a council of state.
Batigue's letter also calls for the apprehension of George W. Bush and French President Nicolas Sarkozy, but neither are likely to be attending the conference. However, Kissinger is a regular Bilderberger attendee and is almost certain to be present in St. Moritz. Kissinger, National Security Advisor and late Secretary of State for President Nixon and President Ford, has been accused of being complicit in a number of war crimes in Indochina, Bangladesh, Chile, Cyprus, and East Timor. Numerous activists have attempted to arrest him over the years under the Geneva Conference, even under the Geneva Conventions Act. In the trial of Henry Kissinger, author Christopher Hitchens documents how Kissinger personally approved bombing campaigns that resulted in thousands of civilian casualties, as well as signing off on the use of deadly chemical agent Orange. United States General Telford Taylor, the former chief prosecuting officer at the Nuremberg trial, stated that Kissinger committed war crimes by giving the nod to bomb Vietnamese villages during the war.
Stock up. Although Bilderberg's primary confab will take place in St. Moritz, other associated meetings will also occur in Zurich and Geneva. Unlike the small group of independent journalists who will travel to the location to do the job that the castrated establishment media refuses to undertake. In Bilderberg, elitists can rely on private jets and helicopters to transport them between the different locations. In recent years, Bilderberg luminaries have decried the increasing number of demonstrators and independent journalists who descend on the scene of each annual meeting, which is the primary reason why members will be hopping around to different locations within the small country of Switzerland to escape the glare of reporters and the unwanted attention of protesters.
Claims by a child apologist that Bilderberg is merely a talking shop that has no influence on setting policy have been vehemently debunked in recent years. Bilderberg chairman Etienne Davignon last year bragged about how euro single currency was a brainchild of the Bilderberg group. A meeting in June in Europe of the Bilderberg Group, an informal club of leading politicians, businessmen, and thinkers chaired by Mr. Davignon, could also improve understanding on future action. In the same way it helped create the euro in the 1990s, he said, as reported by the EU Observer in March 2009. The foundations for the EU and ultimately the euro single currency were laid by the secretive Bilderberger Group in the mid-1950s. Bilderberg's own leaked documents proved that the agenda to create a European common market and a single currency was formulated by Bilderberg in 1955. As we first reported in 2003, a BBC investigative team were allowed to access Bilderberg files, which confirmed that the EU and the euro were the brainchild of Bilderberg. During an interview with a Belgian radio station last year, former NATO Secretary General and Bilderberg member Wiley Klaus admitted that those who attended the conference are mandated to implement decisions that are formulated during the conflab within their respective spheres of influence.
So they go there.
That article was by Paul Joseph Watson, and he is an editor and writer for PrismPlanet.com.
Okay. And,
thank you.
Yeah, so anyway, this is, that was kind of an important article. I thought it was kind of
interesting. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if he's arrested.
Yeah.
Well, if they can get a hold of him.
Yeah. So, anyway, what I wanted to do, so we can, I thought we'd go to a music break, maybe right now.
Okay.
That'd be all right. Today somebody sent this to me, and I was really pleased to see it. And
speak about it again because people.
Yeah, it was a YouTube video that was sent to me by a Facebook friend of mine, and it was called "Korea's Got Talent," and it says, "I dare you don't cry while watching this." And it was very, very true. It was a YouTube video.
Oh.
And the guy, the singer says, "I don't sing that well, but when I sing, I like it. I feel like I become a different person." And his name is Sunbong Choi.
And he is an orphan?
Yeah. And I'm hoping I can get... at the beginning of this is they're talking in Korean, you know?
Oh, okay.
And there's subtitles. But I'm going to try to move it up to...
where he starts singing. Yeah.
유난히 평범해 보이는 한 청년이 다음을 준비하고 있습니다.
You know what? 22 years old. Oh, 22 years old. My name is. It was a little fast, but.
I've been living in very difficult circumstances.
Most of his life. And.
I still feel uncomfortable challenging this competition. Very humble guy. I just wanted to be like a normal other, live like normal other people.
And,
but when I sing, I like become a different person. So here he is. Okay.
Yeah. And,
turn on the volume.
Well, she talks to him a little bit.
Okay, we'll turn on the volume.
She
turn
says,
the
volume. Well, you can't, it,
what you do for a living, but you're a look. I can't tell. I'm a manual worker, he says.
And she laughs and she says,
early in the morning, I look into your application, and you
left the
family
section
blank.
All right, and he just looked at her and says, I was left in an orphanage when I was 3. And when I was 5, I ran away and got beaten by
people
there.
After beaten by the people there.
Right. And he said, and then the one judge said, how did you live on since then? One of the judges asked, and he says, I sold gum or energy drinks on the street. And I had that life for about 10 years. Did you stay with anyone besides you? He said, no, I was alone. So you lived by yourself since you were 5. And he says, I lived like that for 10 years. I slept on the stairs of a public toilet, or in a public toilet, he said. And for 10 years, like a day fly, that's how he lived.
Did you go to school? No.
I took a GED test to get my high school, and high school was the first school I'd been to. And the judge says, you're unbelievable. And I said, are you going to sing today? He says, yes. And he said, do you enjoy singing? And he says, rather than say I enjoy it, he says, singing because I feel like some, I don't know, I forgot. I'm not a good singer, but I just like it. She says, let's hear you sing. Now get ready for this.
give you a little background and preview of the Bilderberg group and some predictions they had.
And this is by GRTV, Global Research Television. And it's about 9 minutes long, but I think we can cut it in a little.
Yeah, if it gets a little ponderous, we'll cut it. But
right,
let's listen to what they have to say.
It's kind of interesting if you're not familiar with the Bilderberg group. So here we go.
Update from the Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca. And now for the real news. The annual meeting of royalty, politicians, business moguls, and academics known as the Bilderberg Conference is set to take place later this week. This year's confab will run from June 9th to the 12th at the Grand Hotel Kempinski in St. Moritz, Switzerland. The conference is a yearly get-together of 130 of the who's who of Europe and North America, from David Rockefeller to Joseph Ackerman to Queen Beatrix. The group, which takes its name from the name of the hotel where the first meeting was held, has traditionally convened under a media blackout, with those members of the press and media moguls in attendance agreeing to forego reporting on the proceedings. Since the group's founding in 1954, however, a handful of researchers and independent journalists have worked to expose the group and its activities, and it is only with the rise of the online alternative media in recent years that Bilderberg has come to mainstream attention. The organization has had to become more open in recent years and now operates an official website, bilderbergmeetings.org, which lists the group's steering committee membership, agenda of past meetings, and press releases, repeating the official justification for the group's secrecy. Bilderberg is a small, flexible, informal, and off-the-record international forum in which different viewpoints can be expressed and mutual understanding enhanced, notes the official press release from the 2010 press conference, before adding, "At the meetings, no resolutions are proposed, no votes taken, and no policy statements issued. All participants attend Bilderberg in a private and not an official capacity." This description is not merely a reflection of the group's modesty. As the annual meeting brings together heads of state, finance and defense ministers, state governors, and other elected representatives with private business moguls, attendees are generally breaking the laws of their respective countries in engaging in the conference. Under the Logan Act, for instance, it is a crime for any U.S. citizen to negotiate with a foreign nation on the USA's behalf. As a gathering of some of the richest and most influential people on the planet, the conference is a lightning rod for criticism and speculation about the group's true purpose. The speculation is not unfounded, as investigative journalists like Jim Tucker and Daniel Esterlin have been able to predict numerous world events from discussions that their sources were able to smuggle out of past conferences. Such instances of prediction include Jim Tucker's successful 2002 prediction based on Bilderberg intel that the Iraq War would be launched in March of 2003, Daniel Esterlin's on-camera revelation from the 2006 conference that the Bilderberg members were planning to pop the housing bubble later that year to precipitate a general banking crisis, and Jim Tucker's 2009 prediction that Bilderberg were going to use the financial crisis to work behind the scenes on the construction of a closer North American governmental integration, something that was once again confirmed by newly revealed Canadian diplomatic cables detailing how lawmakers have been quietly working on just such an integration for years. In 1991, a then unknown governor of Arkansas was invited to attend Bilderberg, the year before becoming President of the United States.
All right, here's the answer. I happened to be in Europe then on my way to Russia. I was invited to go to Bilderberg by Vernon Jordan, a friend of mine and a genuine hero of the civil rights movement. And to the best of my knowledge, NAFTA was not discussed by anybody in my presence. I was talking to people who happened to be from Europe who did not give a rip about NAFTA.
In 1993, Tony Blair attended the Bilderberg meeting in Athens, Greece. The next year, he was appointed leader of the Labour Party. On the campaign trail in 2008, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama disappeared for a secret meeting near Washington. Their private limos were seen entering the Chantilly, Virginia hotel where the Bilderberg meeting was taking place that same day.
The Associated Press has learned that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have met face-to-face. The closed-door meeting comes just days after Obama clinched the Democratic nomination and just one day after Hillary Clinton's campaign announced she's planning to drop out of the presidential race. Campaign aides for both candidates say the meeting was about unity. Initially, it was believed that the secret meeting took place at Clinton's Washington, D.C. home. Obama's spokesman denied that, but won't confirm where the former rivals met.
Robert, why were we not told about this meeting and that the senator wouldn't be on our flight until the doors were shut and we were about to taxi to take off?
Again, we had a desire. Senator Obama had a desire to do some meetings. Others had a desire to meet with him tonight in a private way, and that's what we're doing.
We witnessed at least seven convoys of armed Secret Service entering the Westfields Marriott, and internal sources confirmed that both candidates did attend at least one meeting inside the conference.
Earlier this week, I talked to Andrew Marshall, a research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization, about this year's conference and the significance of the Bilderberg meetings.
And so you have, on the American side, one of the most prominent Bilderberg members is, of course, David Rockefeller, who was at the founding of the meeting in 1954 in the Netherlands. The meeting was co-founded by Prince Bernard of the Netherlands, who is the father of Queen Beatrix, who is a current steering committee member and also the largest shareholder in Royal Dutch Shell. He sort of brought her into the fray in the Bilderberg Group, and she has now been bringing her son into the Bilderberg Group, and sure enough, he will take over for her in the end. Other prominent participants are Henry Kissinger, former U.S. Secretary of State, Zbigniew Brzezinski, former U.S. National Security Advisor, who co-founded the Trilateral Commission with David Rockefeller in 1973. And you have several other monarchs, European monarchs, Queen Sophia and King Juan Carlos of Spain are common participants. And essentially, you get a lot of bankers, financiers, industrialists, the heads of the IMF, World Bank, World Trade Organization, and the major central bank chiefs. So the head of the Federal Reserve, both the Federal Reserve System chairman and the president of the New York Federal Reserve generally attends each and every meeting. And it's usually at these meetings where they actually decide who tends to run these organizations. There tends to be a consensus formed on who's going to be the next, for example, in the current context, who's going to be the next head of the IMF. I think that's something that we'll see being decided at this year's Bilderberg Conference. So look for several of the contenders' names to appear on this year's list, and you can pretty much guarantee it's going to be one of them.
In recent years, mainstream news outlets that have been forced to address the increasingly infamous meetings have resorted to downplaying the meeting's significance, stressing that no decisions are made at the conference and that policy is not set there. This year, the Swedish news outlet TheLocal.se has been the first major outlet to address the meeting. In a piece entitled Debunking the Mystique of the Bilderberg Group, the website quotes a Sweden-based academic who has written a new book on the subject, attempting to dismiss the idea that anything of importance is actually discussed behind closed doors. To suggest that they, the Bilderbergers, are consciously coming together to agree on objectives to change the world is wrong, Dr. Ian Richardson is quoted as saying in the article. This claim is particularly puzzling, given the repeated admissions and revelations that the group has demonstrably been working toward consciously shaping international policy and using their members' influence to implement their policy objectives. Leaked documents from the second ever Bilderberg Conference in 1955 revealed that even at that time, Bilderberg was devoted to the creation of a European Union and a single European currency. 2 years later, the Treaty of Rome, now officially regarded as the birth of the European Union, was signed into existence by, among others, Bilderberg attendee Paul Henry Spaak. In March of 2009, former EU Commissioner and current Bilderberg Steering Committee Chairman Etienne Davignon admitted to the EU Observer that Bilderberg had been instrumental in creating the euro currency in the 1990s. Just last year, former NATO Secretary General and two-time Bilderberg attendee Willy Claes admitted that Bilderberg attendees are expected to use reports from Bilderberg meetings to set policies in their respective countries. Despite all of this evidence to the contrary, look for more mainstream news reports in the coming days dismissing all talk of the importance of the Bilderberg Conference as conspiracy theory. For more on this story and other breaking news and current events, please go to globalresearch.ca. For more research and analysis by James Corbett, please go to corbettreport.com.
So that was a little history on the Bilderberg, is what they've done, and so we'll look forward to see what they're going to be recommending after this meeting.
Yeah.
And maybe there'll be some leaks that'll tell us.
I think, it's like you said, they're going to put somebody in charge of the IMF, and then they're going to...
Well, we know one person who won't be at the Bilderberg meeting.
Who's that?
Dominique. The
IMF guy.
The IMF guy. He's not going to be there. He'll be noticeably absent.
Right. In jail.
In New York.
In townhouse arrest.
Yes.
But nevertheless. Anyway, I wanted to touch on something tonight, on some of the health issues that we have brought up. Excuse me. This one states that forensic evidence emerges that European E. coli superbug was bioengineered to produce human fatalities.
This is the one that we're talking about that's on the news every 5 minutes.
Yes,
first
recently.
They threw out all the cucumbers, then they threw out all the broccoli and
bean sprouts,
tomatoes. And well, it's just like they're waging war on organic farmers.
That's exactly what they're doing.
Destroying the farming.
And even as the veggie blame game is now underway across across Europe, there, where a super-resistant strain of E. coli is sickening patients and filling hospitals in Germany, virtually no one is talking about how E. coli could have magically become resistant to 8 different classes of antibiotic drugs and then suddenly appear in the food supply.
Mm.
This particular E. coli variation is a member of the O104 strain, and the O104 strains are almost never normally resistant to antibiotics. In order for them to acquire this resistance, they must be repeatedly exposed to antibiotics in order to provide the mutation pressure that nudges them toward complete drug immunity. So if you're curious about the origins or the strain of such, you can essentially reverse engineer the genetic code of the E. coli and determine fairly accurately with antibiotics that it was exposed to during its development. This step has now been done, and when you look at the genetic decoding of this 014104 strain, now threatening food consumers across the EU, a fascinating picture emerges of just how it must have come into existence.
Do you think, though, Leo, that it could have a lot to do with all the antibiotics that we put into animals, plus the genetic modifying of the food? We don't even know what's in our food anymore.
There's a mass conspiracy, there's no question about it, and what they're doing contaminating the food supply in general. But with GMOs and everything else. But this one is perhaps even the most diabolical in the fact that they
can trace. So let's see what this article says.
You know,
that's what I was thinking.
That they can actually trace it to something. And the genetic code reveals the history. When scientists at Germany, Robert Koch Institute, decoded the genetic makeup of the 104 strain, they found it to be resistant to all the following classes and combination of antibiotics. I won't go into reading all of them.
Well, just the ones that we know, penicillins and tetracyclines and now dixic acid and
don't even attempt that, please.
Amoxicillin.
Okay.
All those things that we normally get when we go to get
piperacillin and piperacillin, tazobactam and so.
All the things that we use when we go when we have an infection.
Yeah. In addition, this 104 strain possesses an ability to produce special enzymes that give it what might be called bacteria superpowers, known technically as ESBLs. The extended spectrum beta-like masses are enzymes that can be produced by bacteria, making them resistant to these different drugs. which are the most widely used antibiotics in many hospitals, explains the Health Protection Agency at the UK. On top of this, the Q104 strain possesses two genes, okay, that have been making doctors shudder since the 1990s. And why do they make doctors shudder? Because they're so deadly that many people infected with such bacteria experience critical organ failure and simply die.
So how exactly does a bacterial strain come into existence that's resistant to over a dozen antibiotics in eight different drug classes and feature two deadly gene mutations plus ESBL enzyme capability? There's really only one way that this happens, and only one way. You have to expose the strain of E. coli to all eight classes of antibiotic drugs. Usually this isn't done at the same time, of course. You first expose it to penicillin and find the surviving colonies which are resistant to penicillin. You then take those surviving colonies, exposing them to tetracycline. The surviving colonies are now resistant to both penicillin and tetracycline. You then expose them to a sulfa drug and collect the surviving colonies from that and so on, and it's a process of genetic selection done in a laboratory with a desired outcome. This is essentially how some bioweapons are engineered by the U.S. Army in its laboratory facility in Fort Detrick, Maryland. Although the actual process is more complicated than this, the upshot is that creating a strain of E. coli that's resistant to eight classes of antibiotics requires repeated, sustained exposure to those antibiotics. It's virtually impossible to imagine how this could happen all by itself in the natural world. For example, if this bacteria originated in the food, as we've been told, then where did it acquire all this antibiotic resistance, given the fact that antibiotics are not used in vegetables? When considering the genetic evidence that now confronts us, it is difficult to imagine how this could happen in the wild. While resistance to a single antibiotic is common, the creation of a strain of E. coli that's resistant to eight different classes of antibiotics in combination simply defies the laws of genetic permutation in combination in the wild. Simply put, this superbug E. coli strain could not have been created in the wild, and that leaves only one explanation for where it really came from, the lab.
Okay, then, then the next thing they said is that it's engineered and released
into the wild.
And the evidence now points to this deadly strain, or E. coli, being engineered and then either being released into the food supply or somehow escaping from a lab and entering the food supply inadvertently. If you disagree with this conclusion, and you're certainly welcome to, then you are focused,
then you're forced
to conclude that this autobiotic superbug, immune to eight classes of antibiotics, developed randomly on its own. And that conclusion is far scarier than the bioengineered explanation, because it means autobiotic superbugs can simply appear anywhere at any time without cause. That would be quite an exotic theory indeed. My conclusion actually makes more sense. This strain of E. coli was almost certainly engineered and then released into the food supply for a specific purpose. What would that purpose be? It's obvious, I hope. It's all problem, reaction, solution, at work here. First, cause a problem, a deadly strain of E. coli in the food supply. Then wait for the public reaction. Huge outcry, the population is terrorized by E. coli. In response to that, enact your desired solution. Total control over the global food supply, an outlawing of raw sprouts, raw milk, and raw vegetables. Raw vegetables, even. But that's what this is all about, of course. The FDA relied on the same phenomenon in the USG and the USA when pushed for its recent Food Safety Modernization Act, which essentially outlaws small family organic farms unless they lick the boots of the FDA regulators. The FDA was able to crush farm freedom in America by piggybacking on the widespread fear that followed E. coli breakouts in the U.S. food supply. When people are afraid, remember, it's not difficult to get them to agree to almost any level of regulatory tyranny. And making people afraid of their food is a simple matter. A few government press releases emailed to the mainstream media affiliates.
Is all it takes.
Affiliates is all it takes.
First being the natural medicine, then attack the food supply. Now remember, all this is happening on the heels of the EU ban on medicinal herbs and nutritional supplements.
Which has just happened here.
Yeah,
okay,
a ban that brutally outlaws the nutritional therapies that help keep people healthy and free from disease. Now, all these herbs and supplements are outlawed. The next step is to make people afraid of fresh food. That's because fresh vegetables are medicinal, and as long as the public has the right to buy fresh vegetables, they can always prevent disease. But if you can make people afraid of fresh vegetables or even outlaw them altogether, then you can force the entire population on a diet of dead foods and processed foods that promote degenerative diseases and bolster the profits of powerful drug companies. It's all part of the same agenda, you see. Keep people sick, deny them access to healing herbs and supplements, then profit from their suffering at the hands of the global drug cartels. GMOs play a similar role in this, of course. They're designed to contaminate the food supply with genetic code that causes widespread infertility among human beings. And those who are somehow able to reduce after exposure to GMOs still suffer from degenerative diseases that enrich the drug companies from treatment.
Do you recall which country was targeted in the Larius and E. coli scare? Spain. Why Spain? You can recall that leaked cables from WikiLeaks reveal that Spain resisted the introduction of GMOs into its agricultural system, even as the U.S. government covertly threatened political retaliation for its resistance. This false blaming of Spain for the E. coli deaths is probably retaliation for Spain's unwillingness to jump on the GMO bandwagon. And that's the real story behind the economic devastation of Spain's vegetable farmers. It's one of the subplots being pursued along with the E. coli superbug scheme.
Food as a weapon of war created by Big Pharma. By the way, the most likely explanation of where this strain of E. coli was engineered is that the drug giants came up with it on their own labs. Who else has access to all the antibiotics and equipment needed to manage the targeted mutations of potentially thousands of E. coli colonies? The drug companies are uniquely positioned to both carry out this point and profit from it. In other words, they have the means and the motive to engage in precisely such actions. Aside from the drug companies, perhaps only the infectious disease regulators themselves have this kind of laboratory capacity. The CDC, for example, could probably pull this off if they really wanted to.
The proof that somebody engineered this E. coli strain is written up in the DNA of the bacteria. That's forensic evidence. And what it reveals cannot be denied. The strain underwent repeated and prolonged exposure to 8 different classes of antibiotics, and then it somehow managed to appear in the food supply. How do you get to that if not through a well-planned scheme carried out by a rogue scientist? There is no such thing as spontaneous mutation into a strain that is resistant to the top 8 classes of brand-name antibiotic drugs being sold by Big Pharma today. Such mutations have to be deliberate. Once again, if you disagree with this assessment, then what you're saying is that no, it wasn't done deliberately. It happened accidentally. And again, I'm saying that even scarier, because that means the antibiotic contamination of our world is now at such an extreme level of overkill that a strain of E. coli in the wild can be saturated with 8 different classes of antibiotics to the point where it naturally develops into its own deadly superbug. If that's what people believe, then that's the most scary. That's almost a scarier theory than the bioengineering explanation.
A new era has begun: bioweapons in your food. Well, this is quite a long article, Leo.
Yeah, I know.
It keeps going.
But actually, no, it stops right there.
Anyway,
you want to read antibiotics in your food?
But in either case, no matter what you believe, the simple truth is that the world is now facing a new era of global superbug strains of bacteria that can't be treated with any known pharmaceutical. They can all, of course, be readily killed with colloidal silver, which is exactly why the FDA and the World Health Regulators have viciously attacked colloidal silver companies all these years. They can't have the public getting their hands on a natural antibiotic that really works, you see. that would defeat the whole purpose of making everybody sick in the first place. In fact, these strains of superbugs can be quite readily treated with a combination of natural full-spectrum antibiotics from plants such as garlic, ginger, onions, and medicinal herbs. On top of that, probiotics can help balance the flora of the digestive tract and crowd out the deadly E. coli that might happen by. A healthy immune system and a well-functioning digestive tract that can fight off E. coli superbug infection. But that's yet another fact that this medical community doesn't want you to know. They much prefer you to remain a helpless victim, lying in the hospital, waiting to die with no option available to you. That's modern medicine for you. They cause the problems that they claim to treat, and they won't even treat you with anything that works in the first place. Nearly all the deaths now attributed to this E. coli outbreak are easily and readily avoidable. These are deaths of ignorance. But even more, they may also be deaths from a new era of food-based bioweapons unleashed by either group of mad scientists or agenda-driven institutions that has declared war on the human population.
Yep. So, just so you know, 22 fatalities have so far been reported, with 2,153 people now sick and possibly facing kidney failure.
Well.
Agricultural ministry in Germany said that even though they now know the source of the outbreak is a German sprout farm, they are still not lifting their warnings for people to avoid eating tomatoes and lettuce. In other words, keep the people afraid.
Mm-hmm.
The German variant of E. coli, known as O104, is a hybrid of the strains that can cause bloody diarrhea, kidney damage, and called hemolytic
uremic syndrome.
A total of 10 European nations have reported outbreaks of the E. coli strain, mostly from people who had visited northern Germany. So, anyway, folks, not the coolest
thing.
That's
from the Health Ranger?
Yeah, that's the Health Ranger.
I think.
At naturalnews.com.
Actually, it was by Mike Adams. Yeah, Mike Adams, the Health Ranger.
Yep. Excellent article. So
he brings us a lot of things that are very interesting.
Yeah. So anyway, that I thought I should bring that up because that was kind of a very real thing. Now, let's see, there was one more. Yeah, this one I wanted to read too. You want to read this or do you felt it?
Yeah, depleted uranium used to target Libya.
Yeah.
U.S.-led NATO forces have used depleted uranium, cluster bombs, and other illegal substances while targeting residential areas in the Libyan capital of Tripoli, a human rights activist says. After visiting Tripoli, Randy Short told Press TV that the high number of civilians targeted and injured by illegal bombs in the residential areas has caused a lot of determination by the people to resist Western intervention. Oh, I don't blame them, huh?
That's what we're doing. We're contaminating the entire Middle East with this depleted uranium.
Well, we did that in Eastern Europe in Sarajevo.
Yeah. Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen.
Let's see. I've been to one particular area in which Libyan dictator's son, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi's house, is located. In that community, which was a residential, I saw the damage to civilian homes. Short went on to say that the military installations housing mustard gas and yellowcake uranium are no longer secure, and this can provide easy access to illegal weapons and could also be used as an excuse for the war by the West, maybe on Iran. He stressed that the military base should be looked after by the national Libyan government. Short added that his aim on this trip was to see what actually was going on in Libya, adding that there is a big difference between the situation on the ground and what is being reported on CNN and Al Jazeera. U.S., British, French, Canadian, Dutch, and Belgian warplanes have been conducting strikes on Libya since March 19th under UN Security Council Resolution 1973 that authorized all necessary measures to protect civilians. But, of course, they're just dumping it on civilians.
That's what they're doing now. So, you know, it's just getting rid of this stuff. You know? It's unbelievable. Let's see, was there anything else I wanted to read to you tonight?
think we did the short audio there. Okay.
Yeah, I was kind of looking for it.
We only have about 4 minutes.
Yeah. I was kind of looking about it. So hot in here tonight. Well, let's go back to.
We did have some short ones. Now we can't find them.
Yeah, I'll be right there, folks. Hang on. I've got more of these things. Somewhere.
We just have 3 minutes, Leo. So you better find something quick or forever hold your peace on that.
Oh, we read most of these things last week, so I didn't know.
Yeah. Well, anyway,
we've kind of come
to the end of, we brought a lot of news, and Larry brought us...
A lot of news and a lot of views.
Yeah, Larry brought us some interesting things from the union.
Yeah. And...
So it was good to hear from him tonight. Very, very good.
Yeah. So that was good.
They're really working hard for working people.
Yeah, they are. And we're happy to...
feature him.
To feature him on our show as often as we do. I don't know if I read this last week, but I definitely wanted to read it this week. Fascinating report about where, how would they do take it down? An article by Newsmax that was out a couple of last week, I took the link, but they don't have it now.
Well, you got link too. Of course, the most incredible
Wiener
is still, you know,
right.
That's all you look at is that ugly face.
But the actual report was that McDonald's created half of all U.S. new jobs in May. Half of all the jobs created in the United States were created by McDonald's.
We probably pay $8 an hour.
In May, yeah. They're absolutely amazing.
And they count those as jobs?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's amazing. And
I remember you told me that last week.
Last week, right?
Yeah.
I didn't
and I
read
said,
the article.
Oh, we should keep that and read it, but when you went to the link, it didn't come up, which
no,
is too bad.
No, I didn't know that they took down the link. No, it must have been.
It was just a temporary one. That's
yeah.
Too bad.
That's what happens so much of the time. Oh, this is fascinating. I mean, I think we can finish with this one tonight. I wanted this article about if you're doing this, it can trigger anxiety, depression, and illness. Right?
American drug and biotechnology companies are currently in the process of developing 850 new drugs targeted at women. These drugs, which are either in clinical trials or awaiting review by the FDA, include drugs for breast and ovarian cancer, autoimmune diseases, depression, and Alzheimer's diseases. Among the drugs are an arthritis medication that uses nanotechnology to target and a migraine medication that selectively blocks transmission of pain signals to the brain. In separate records, RH Pharma has found that researchers are working on 299 medicines for heart diseases and stroke and 98 medicines for health for lung cancer. Well, I hope they can find something that works for people.
Yeah, but it's just interesting that they're targeting 850 drugs.
Well, I hope some of them work. We have a lot of people that are very ill.
Yeah, don't count on it.
Yeah.
Just another way to make a buck.
We're right to the end of the
yeah.
show.
Yeah, so we want to thank everybody.
Yeah, we appreciate your joining us tonight.
Very good time.
And we look forward to your joining us tomorrow, actually Leo tomorrow, and then joining us again next week on Tuesday. We won't be on this week, Friday night. We have...
George will be joining us next week.
Next week.
In the meantime, I want to thank everybody who's joined us, and we want to, and we put put out a whole lot of news tonight.
Yeah, we'll be on tomorrow night, Wednesday night,
yep.
And Thursday night, just Leo will be on.
Yeah.
But we look forward to sharing that with you, too. And good night,
yeah,
folks. Have a good night.
Have a great night.